Ryan. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic, Rachel. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah, just pretty good?
Yeah, you know, I've got a big celebration coming up.
Oh, an anniversary?
Yeah, our anniversary, in fact.
Of what?
Well, pretty soon it's going to be our 10th anniversary together. Now, this isn't as big of a deal as the 30th year of ascension for the Centauri, but it's a pretty big deal for us.
Yeah, well, at least 10 years of us having met each other, not necessarily 10 years of us being in a relationship. That comes a little later, but...
It's coming up close.
It's coming up close, people. So, we're Yum Yum Podcast, the podcast with the most yum yum energy out of them all. We named ourselves after the wonderfully written line of dialogue from Star Trek Discovery from its second season finale, in which a character sexily, sensually, comedically replied, "Yum yum." And many people say to me, "Ryan, you don't need to explain yum yum every time. We all know why it's called yum yum." But there are some people out there listening for the first time who may not understand the name, may not understand the reference, may need some clarification. And there are some people out there who don't like yum yum as a line of dialogue. They don't like that we named our podcast after it. There are some people who say, "Hey, why do we have to go through the rigmarole of yum yum?" And that's because someone sat down and wrote that line, and we are just brave knights who are carrying on that mantle for everybody to remember that that was a line of dialogue that got written, and somebody okayed it, and then somebody said it for money. And that's the important thing of, if someone can write yum yum in a modern prestige script and get away with it, well, doesn't that make you feel a little bit better on the inside? It makes me feel better on the inside. But we are talking about Babylon 5. We are rewatching, reviewing, going over Babylon 5. So if you have not seen the series before, we recommend that you do, because we do spoil things, not just within
and
this episode.
And it's a good show.
It's a fun...
You should watch it.
It's an interesting show. It's a fun show. We do enjoy ourselves and we do enjoy it. So you have been warned. Rachel, we watched season 2 episode... Ooh, I actually can't remember the episode number. Is it episode 7? I think we're up to.
Yeah, I think it's 7.
And we had an episode a couple back now where I asked you who had yum yum energy, and we both kind of sadly agreed that nobody had yum yum energy. Mm-hmm. No one had YYE. I am going to make the claim that this is the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in this episode
there
has YYE. There's not a single person.
Bucket load of YYE in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we get Jakar's sex robe.
Yeah.
That alone is fully YYE, and that's just a slither of this episode.
I am going to say it. Every single person, even Sheridan, who's probably the most straight-laced in the episode, even he had YYE. Everyone could have and should have said yum yum at mm-hmm. some point in this episode. See, season 2, it's ups and downs, you know, it's completely, the pendulum swings one way and then it swings back the other. We had an episode where nobody had YYE. This is an episode where we can't award it to just one person. We have to award it to everybody, the small players, the big players, everybody was just licking their lips throughout this episode, just wanting to scream out yum yum to their heart's content. And I absolutely adored that. But what episode of Babylon 5 are we actually delving into?
I do want to note that I think Delenn is the least.
Oh, I beg to differ. Did you see her in the hair curler scene?
Anything else? Is that painful? Actually, it's oddly relaxing.
So this is episode 7, which is entitled Soulmates.
Mm-hmm.
Now that Londo has permission to rid himself of 2 of his 3 wives,
mm-hmm.
meddlesome-wise... Sorry.
You should apologize.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, well. They do have full titles in a different episode.
Mm-hmm.
Now that Londo has permission to rid himself of two of his three meddlesome wives, he must decide which one he'll keep. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Talia, Troublesome, Psycorp, X, Keith,
you don't know how.
No,
that's the actor. You're trying to get his last name. Don't bother. Just don't bother. It must be Polish or something weird. My last name's Slawinski. Don't even get me started.
Keith Sabacha.
Sure.
Arrives.
Soulmates. The episode where Londo's wives appear finally. We've heard about them. We've seen them. We've been told so much, given so much, yet so little. But what we were given was enough to make you excited to hear the pitch of this episode. That is my history. To get into it is, I did know the pitch of this one because I read the DVD booklet back in the day and I saw the pictures and I said, oh, they must be, no. And then they were his wives. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, yes. This is an episode in which I love this episode. It's not a favorite. I'm not going to say it's a masterpiece. I'm not going to say it's a quintessential viewing, but it is a great, fun time episode that its pitch sells itself. This is an episode that writes itself, and when you watch it, it delivers.
Even the Talia plot?
Oh, even the Talia plot. I had a ball of a time. You remove the Talia plot. This is the episode where Londo's three wives come onto the station. He has to divorce one of them. It gives you...
Two.
Yeah, he has to divorce two of them. Sorry. This gives you all the goods. That pitch, that premise, that idea, you imagine up what it could be. You can imagine up what his wives are going to be. You imagine up his dynamic with them. And this episode, it gives you it. This is a quintessential episode in terms of the example of you hear the premise and you imagine what it could be, and it is that to your heart's content. This is a fun time. Mm-hmm. I like this episode a lot. When I think of B5 episodes, this isn't obviously one of the top ones, but when I think of fun times
is one of my favorites.
I love it. I love it. I always have, always will. What about yourself? I mean, you knew that Londo's wives, he had three of them. Did you ever actually expect them to be in the show? Because this is a good chunk of episodes have passed and we know they exist, but did you ever expect to see them?
Set it up and paid it off.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't expecting them to appear all at once the way that they did. Mm. I thought we were going to get, like, an episode every so often where one of his wives had to come along for whatever reason. But I love what they decided to do. And I love all of his three wives.
Oh, they're all great.
I think I do love Dimov the most.
Oh, we all love. She's the best. She is. But Daguerre has some great moments.
Mm.
So what was it like when you actually sat down and watched it all those years ago? Because, again, you didn't know that they were going to come here. I didn't mention the wives story. This is just one of those ones where we just watched the next episode and it turned up.
Yeah. I just remember having fun with it. Every single time I watch this episode, I'm like, yeah, it's fun. And it's smooth. Like, it has some parts that feel a bit clunky just because of the mechanics needed for an episode. It's not perfect.
No.
And it does have that sense of being a sort of filler episode, but at the same time it's focusing on character and building the world out, and I appreciate that.
You can face him in his bed or his deathbed with equal calm.
I am what I was made by my father, by Londo, by society.
Breeding will tell.
One of the aspects to talk about negatives that I always look at this one with and go, I don't like that, was the Matt Stoner, Talia Winters side of the story. Because I have been on record, I've not been a Talia fan in the past, still currently not one. And I've grown, even as a kid watching this, maybe this is because I grew up with TNG and I became keenly aware of this, but she is the female character that is defined by her relationship to others, whether it be characters in this show or ones that come in and out or former flames or teachers. And I find her to be a very one-note, weak character, and not in a way that I think is entertaining, because you can have a weak character become strong. We've gone over this with Talia. And this was an example of, oh my God, I can't believe that they're doing the, she had a husband that we didn't know about, and he's a sleazy, creepy, weirdo man.
The sting and the angle.
Oh, yeah, we'll get...
And, when they do that, mm-hmm. Oh my fucking God.
And I just, when I think back on this one, and I think of something to pick on that I didn't like, is... Oh, it's a Talia as a victim plot yet again. Mm-hmm. And it's a creepy ex comes to the station yet again. And I always just kind of get, eh. And one of the things that I'll come out straight out with is, and I my position has completely changed, is I did not like the Matt Stoner portrayal in previous watches of this. I don't know. I think what I didn't like about it was he was such a creep that I felt that it was too on the nose. That has changed significantly.
I enjoyed it a lot more on this watch too.
I loved his performance.
So entitled.
It was everything it needed to be to match the tone of this episode. He was fantastic to me on this watch, but in previous ones I lump him in the trash with the myriad of faceless, nameless, generic creepo guys in these 90s sci-fi shows. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about? You've watched DS9, you've watched Star Trek, TNG and Voyager, and you've watched Babylon 5, and
he's a strange man of the week.
Weirdo. Yeah, how many of these, the creepy lover guy, have we seen?
Too many to count.
And how many of them leave an actual memorable, or even, dare I say, fun performance?
A countable number.
Exactly. I am actually having a hard time.
I'm sure that there's some, but I can't name them right now.
I had fun watching Matt Stoner. But what about you? What's been your kind of viewpoints on this side of the story? Because, like I said, we all think of this as the Londo's wives episode. We think of this as the Londo gets divorced. My three wives. But that isn't the only part of this story. There's this side of it. What has your journey been with this?
I never really liked it. It always felt like a distraction from the Londo plot. I just wanted more Londo, more Londo's wives.
Yeah.
More Jakar. Because we get a nice amount of Jakar slotted into this episode.
Yeah, you want more comedic hijinks with his wives interacting with characters we know.
Yes.
But you do get that in the entire... They even interact with Franklin. Mm-hmm. Franklin almost isn't in this episode. Then he comes in and he's like, no, guys, I'm very important to the plot, by the way. And I'm like, whoa, Franklin, calm the fuck down.
Chill out,
man. I'm glad you're here. I almost didn't question that you weren't here until you popped up to remind me that you're here.
Like, he gives a sticker.
So you did not like this side of the story?
No, I always just found it like, oh, I don't want this. Get back to the other stuff. Like, I get how it matches in a way, like the thematic links that it has with the part of the episode that I like so much better. I still prefer the Londo side of things.
Oh, of course. 100%.
But it doesn't feel as much of a, oh, fuck off, kind of B plot. It just feels like, okay.
Why was it such a
bit of a break?
Why other than just, you just want more of the Londo stuff, what else about this just hasn't worked for you?
Talia's acting as well. I never find her to be a stellar performance because she doesn't get a lot to go off a lot of the time. And the other, they keep on telling us who Talia is and what Talia feels.
And her dynamics to other characters. Mm. I really felt that actually on this watch of, they really want me to think that her and Garibaldi have more of a thing than they actually do.
And I'm always left a bit confused as to how much Stoner put those thoughts in her head. Because it's just like, well, it would make sense if she'd been honest with him because he was a mentor before they were kind of forced into marriage, right?
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, well, you wanted out of the core. And it's just like, we haven't got that sense.
Oh, God, no. God, no. When have we ever got that sense that she's ever wanted to leave the core?
But the way that I read that performance was that he was being honest.
Oh, yeah.
In that, and then that's what she wanted, and that he's bringing out that desire of hers that's underneath the compliance of, I would rather not be a part of the core because I don't trust it. I don't, like, I'm a part of it, but I'm uncomfortable with it.
I still say they never work towards that. That is an aspect of this side that I still don't believe, is this notion that Tali would ever even be tempted to lose her powers, because I really believe what she says
when she's like, I don't know what I would be if I didn't have my talents. And I'm like, bitch, neither do I, because that's basically all of your character.
The only way this could work to me, and this still doesn't work because of the type of character Matt Stoner is he needs to come up to her and convince her eloquently about this cure and tempt her to want it. That would make more sense by, schmoozing with her and having a rapport. But that's not his character. He's too much of a shit stain and a creep and a piece of garbage. You can't have
him. He's a human skid mark.
You can't have him realistically do that. So you need to, in your script, have it that apparently Talia already has wanted this, already has had a desire for this or an inkling for this, for Matt to come and pluck at that string. But we, the audience, don't know that she's ever had that. You could argue that we, the audience, know that she is becoming aware of how creepy the Psychor is, but Matt doesn't know that.
No.
Because when we met her, and even still now, she's in a happy, indoctrinated, obedient Psychor member.
We are skeeved out by what she says and how she feels about it, but at this stage, she hasn't given us the impression that she feels that way about it.
Well, I think I kind of disagree. I feel like she is becoming less and less secure with the core. But it doesn't mean that Matt Stoner knows. And he's treating it as if this is something that's always been within Talia. That it hasn't. It just hasn't been here. You're right. That is an aspect of this that you just have to take it on the face value for the story to work. Yeah. Because Talia has no agency otherwise, because that's her agency, is do I or do I not take this deal? And that's the way of forcing her to be able to have that conflict within herself, is just saying, hey, apparently this is a conflict you have within yourself that's well known to Matt Stoner, and you just have to go, oh, okay, fair enough. An aspect that I just did not like, and I don't know how I feel about it nowadays still, is Talia is just the lady that is easy to use for the weird, gross sex things. Because the real goal is Matt Stone is going to control her brain to come back and he'll breed with her. That's the plot. When you remove all the comedy stuff, that's the plot. And we already talked about, and people push back against
it. Reminds me of Kilgrave and Jessica Jones.
Yeah, it does. And he's an empath too, in a way. You know, he uses the power of persuasion and suggestion. Yeah. And we got pushed back for when I said that Jason Ironheart also groomed Talia because the age, she was an underage, she was a teenage girl and he was her teacher. And this is the same thing here. They're not afraid to say that the Psi-Corps grooms people in multiple ways, not just the sexual grooming, but we've talked about this recently with Talia's handler. That was when she was a kid, and how they were brainwashing her, and just the whole core is this, the whole process of indoctrination. So the whole entire thing is creepy like that, and we get it. We get that's the thing, but it's like after a certain point, Talia just becomes an object of what's Talia's story this week? I don't know, one of her old pedophile mentors comes to the station and wants to fuck with her. And it kind of is gross in an otherwise fun episode. Like, it's really gross and disgusting, but it's still a very fun episode, but like, the pitch of the B-plot is Talia's getting brainwashed to go back and get impregnated by this guy against her will, and that's the plot, and we have to root for Garibaldi to punch him in the face. Again, lacking agency for Talia there, because not even like Talia overcomes this plot herself, Garibaldi does. You could argue the B-plot,
he got a feeling.
Here's the question I ask you: is the B-plot Talia's?
Yeah.
Or is it Garibaldi's plot?
It's about Talia, but it's not because of Talia.
You know the film The Maltese Falcon?
Yeah.
You know how the film's called The Maltese Falcon, and the Maltese Falcon is the thing that everybody's after?
The linchpin, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's what Talia is. She's the Falcon. She's the thing that is kicking off the incident here for the guys involved. It doesn't mean it's her story.
It's not her journey that we're following.
She doesn't overcome anything.
She's just at the center of it.
She gets saved so that Garibaldi, to us, can look good because he managed to outsmart the guy who's going to harm Talia, and he saves the princess.
But there's a line in that scene when, like, they're unpacking, like, what they think happened with Stoner and how, like, you know, he got turned into an empath and was dismissed from the core for all of those reasons. But I think I always have felt that it's more Stoner's idea to go after Talia than it is the core.
Oh, I think so. I've always thought that too.
But like Garibaldi frames it as like,
Garibaldi and Sheridan together.
Yeah. Like the Corps has sent you to try and get Talia so that you can do this. But I think it's more about Stoner wanting to control Talia.
Yeah, because she got away. The powerful moment for Talia is her rejecting to play his game again. And walks out of the room. That's the yes for her. And it's, again, make it about, I don't know, give her an actual thing to do in this plot other than to be the thing that has things happen at them and to them. Stop making her an object in which creeps have a go at her. It's just tiresome.
Garibaldi is creeping on her still.
Talking negatively still about this, but I gotta say, on this rewatch here, I actually thoroughly enjoyed this because, although it's gross, the comedy and the thrill of seeing the crew get this fucker was really, really enthralling.
So satisfying.
The guy who plays Matt Stoner,
his performance really clicked with me this time.
Oh, yeah.
I feel it. Like, I settled into the kind of creepy sleaziness that he's emanating.
Did she tell you all about me?
No.
Would you like me to tell you all about her? Is that it? What she likes to hear? Where she likes to be touched?
Don't push it.
He's not pretending not to be the creep of the episode.
No.
And there's something about that that's liberating. I could not help but think about Ivanova's ex-boyfriend, Malcolm, the creepy xenophobic Australian guy, and what a flat line that was, and how
the sweater.
Oh, the sweater.
The sweater.
But
it can't be considered a flat line with that sweater.
But you did not believe that she had a relationship with this guy. You did not believe that she was wooed by this guy. You did not believe anything because it's just too far beyond the realm of possibility. Here, it all adds up. She was forced into a marriage with this guy. He's forcing his way here with his empathic abilities. He's super cocky because he thinks no one can touch him. And the performer is allowed to absolutely have the time of his life because his character is having the time of his life. And it all adds up. It all comes together. It is all believable. One plus one equals two here. This is the creepy ex-boyfriend thing, ex-husband, the creepy ex, actually is successful here because they're not pretending that he's not the creepy boyfriend and the creepy ex. They're not hiding that. And they're having a wink and a nudge and a bit of fun with that. The guy who plays Matt Stoner, he has the biggest shit-eating grin I've ever seen from a person. And you can't wait for him to get punched.
Oh, you want somebody to slug him so bad. And, like, I think it's when Garibaldi and Sheridan have left the, like, interrogation room. And they're just like, nobody's that smug with an ace up their sleeve.
He was a funny character. I don't think I've ever truly appreciated the humor from him because I'm here for the wives, just like you. I'm here for Londo. I'm here for Jakar. I'm here even for the bad hair day with Delenn. That I have neglected what a brilliant, brilliant comedic performance this guy is giving, as well as a genuinely disturbing performance. He knows how to ride the line, but he's got zingers. He's got zingers for days, and I loved all of them. My personal favorite is not necessarily the greatest one. He has many, but I liked when Garibaldi says, "I'm going to keep an eye on you," and he has a zinger of, "Oh, you should use both eyes. You'll need them." And then he walks out with this absolute...
I like the... Oh, I should have asked for more of it then.
Oh, well.
More for it then. Oh, well.
You know, easy come, easy go. I also really appreciate when Garibaldi was reading the things and he's like, "Do you need me to read the big words for you there?" Garibaldi absolutely got his ass blasted in this episode, and it was delightful to see that, especially since we've been noting down what a character Garibaldi is. We still like Garibaldi, but it is good to see others, even if they're a guest star character, put him in his place and motivate him to be a better character than he is. Because that's the thing, too, is it's funny and it's great to see this type of the Garibaldi character get insulted for being a dumbass and being a bastard cop and being a jealous guy over this woman. And it's great to see Talia say, "Hey, fuck you, Garibaldi." It's all great to see that. But it is also wonderful because it actually motivates him to be a better cop in the episode. He's seeing this guy be so cocky and he's seeing the pain from Talia that it's actually making him want to do his job in a way that makes him smarter than in Survivors, let's say.
Oh,
in
boy,
which, yeah. Yeah, he does.
Night and day.
He's actually a lot more persistent and clever in this. I understood what type of cop he was in this one.
And you're like, yeah, you are the head of security because you do have that gut feeling and that you gnaw away at a problem until you can figure it out. And I really like the way that that was mirrored with Jakar as well, because I'm enjoying noting on this particular watch through how they're kind of weaving in those similarities between Garibaldi and Jakar, because I've always kind of felt that their friendship sort of
Happens. It is very much like, but friendship with Londo ended, friendship started with Jakar.
Yeah, and I'm like, no, like they're similar in lots of different ways, and I'm enjoying noting those kind of small sprinkles.
Yeah, This side of the plot just went down a lot easier this time. One of the things that perplexes me, and I'm curious what you think about this, is I have never... it's only this episode that really gets me this feeling, is... Does Garibaldi actually love Talia?
I don't know.
Because I always took it as he was just wanting to have, you know, a bit of sexy time with her. I didn't think it was anything of a genuine emotion.
Yeah, she's hot. I want to bang her.
Yeah, I want to look at her ass. He's being a lech.
Mm.
But this episode treats it as if it is a genuine love. Where do you land? What do you think about this?
Because I don't buy it.
No?
No.
Not even after his little nice conversation about his dad with Talia in one of the previous episodes where they kind of had a little bit of a more tender bonding moment. You don't think that scene was warming us up to buy this idea?
It doesn't work for me. If that's what it wanted to do, it doesn't work for me. How about you?
No. No, 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 no. God, no. I don't think it's fair of me to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. I can't buy it because, like, in context, the two actors were, in fact, married at the time and their marriage was splitting up at the time. And,
That chemistry ain't happening.
The chemistry is not there, but to be fair, they're actors. They're acting through it. That doesn't matter, and I didn't know that for the longest time. I didn't buy it, and I don't buy it because it comes from an insincere place to begin with, which is he wants to fuck her, that is it. And now they're trying to treat it as if he genuinely loves her. And if that is the case, I think he's a more disgusting character because... His sexual attraction has now become possessive of her. It's not as if he likes her for a personality or genuinely thinks of her to be somebody he has romantic feelings for. It stems from what we've been shown. He wants to fuck her. And now he's so jealous of any other guy wanting to fuck her, he's going to turn on to ultra cop mode. And that makes me like him less.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me as a guy not like him. I don't like that. It's toxic and weird and gross. All in line with his character. I'll say that. if that's a deliberate thing, that's the thing. I don't know if it is that route. I don't know if they know that that's a route that it could be taken as. Because if it is, and if she stayed and the show actually developed that and went with it, I would buy it. I would buy that he has to come to terms with the fact that he's more so sexually attracted to her and he's being kind of a sexist pig and wanting to possess her as his thing, as his girl, yet they have nothing... there. That would have been an interesting way to go, but obviously that's not where they went. But I don't know if that was even on the table of thought. I think we're supposed to think,
they're soulmates.
Maybe they're soulmates.
And I'm like, no, no.
That's funny. I met this woman and I took to her immediately. Then I met this guy who had hurt her and instantly I hated him.
Women, Barry, believe, as do some humans, that souls travel together. Some groups of souls are drawn one to the other in life to relive good relationships from the past. And if possible, to make right the bad ones.
Dylan has a bad hair day.
What?
And Ivanova,
but she just got hair.
Ivanova helps her, and it's really cute. And then they insinuate that she's going to get a period soon. That she's... a menstruating person now.
Yeah, that means that she's capable of getting pregnant the human way. Isn't that neat?
Yeah.
Did you think about that when you first watched it, when it ended with that gag? Did you think about that?
Mm-hmm.
That immediately came to your mind?
Yep. I'm like, I don't know why this matters, but she wants to be a bridge. That's another way to do it.
So you picked that up straight away, huh?
Yeah.
I did not. I was just like, ha ha ha. Ha, it's one of those gags, you know. Women sure do be crazy. Because that's this whole entire story is.
Yeah.
Oh, isn't it? Being a woman, huh? Oh, boy.
It's hard work.
You got to put curlers in your hair. And the guys, they just don't understand. Look at Linnea. But he doesn't even have hair.
Linnea looks like so confused, but so like he's still looking at her so fondly.
He's kind of jealous.
Like he's so in love with her.
Yeah. But you can see like he's like, I wish I had hair. I wish I could do that. Like, oh well.
Ooh.
I can't. I've got bone. I've got a bone head. I just
like to me that's more like he doesn't wish that he could have it. He's just wondering what that would be like because he's such a curious person.
Oh, yeah. Can you... I'm so sorry, but I can't believe that this is in an episode. The pitch in the writer's room, right? Peter David, the guest writer for this one, came in and said, hey, JMS, I'm a big fan. I'm a friend. I'm thinking, can I end this episode? Can Delenn, I don't know, she's got hair, right? Can she have a bad hair day? And JMS slapped
him. She doesn't know how to do it.
And JMS slapped his knee laughing and go, oh, that's brilliant. Let's put it in. And they did.
Yeah.
I don't know if this was in the story Bible that they had, JMS, but I hope so. Where like there's a big chapter called Delenn's hair. And this is like, you know, arc one of that anime. I love it. I love this. It's a very humanizing thing for Delenn. Not only because it's funny and cute, but Mira Filan is allowed to play the far more sweet, innocent, kind of comedic, dare I say, even more feminine side of Delenn.
We are so far away from shady Delenn of season one and The Gathering.
Where's her rings? Where's her rings?
But I love the way that she so humbly asks Ivanova for help and how Ivanova's really like, oh, I don't know, like this is not what I was expecting and this isn't really my thing.
Yeah, Ivanova is saying, hey, can you not use me as the other female character, you know, to do like the feminine-y things because I'm... You know, I'm pretty butch. And Delenn's like, come on.
You do your hair, Ivanova. Yeah, Susan, you know how to do this.
Yeah, sometimes you put a little plait. Come on, help me. I'm Delenn. You can't help but like Delenn in this story. It's not a story. It's just a gag. But
yeah.
I think Mira Filan gets so much.
It pops in and out.
Mira Filan gets so much fun stuff to do here with it. And then she does get balanced out by the conversation she has with Jakar, in which she's fooled Delenn, the wise, in which she's talking about soulmates and cultures and love and tradition and spirituality. And man, Mira Filan could just deliver those lines, huh? I don't know if I, as an actor, could deliver those lines. There are just some people where hearing those words come out of them feel right. And she definitely had that skill, that talent.
And I found her speech, particularly in this one, but also thinking back to the Star Stuff monologue that she had a few episodes ago now. The way that she explains the world and the universe, I find so reassuring.
Yeah, as fun as it is for me on paper, the season one Delenn of being the shady, seemingly nice, da-da-da-da-da performance, I do prefer this. I do prefer when she gives these monologues, I believe them more. And I know she's still shifty and still hiding things and still doing all of that stuff, but... Because the script is trying to, in season two, make us warm to her and make us see the more human side of this hybrid she is.
Yeah, and the fact that she's dealing with the physical attributes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The physical with the hair and the period stuff and all that. But yeah, and then just, again, in the writing of it, they're showing her to be more vulnerable, more cutesy, more fun. And I don't know. I found it very endearing. I haven't really
been drawn to Delenn on this watch thus far, and this is probably the closest I've been drawn to her, honestly, and it's in a silly throwaway thing that you could argue would not need to be here, and in the modern reboot probably would not be included.
No.
And I
do find it interesting that the trivia on IMDb noted that Mira didn't want the line about the period and like the cramps in the episode. She was like,
it's too juvenile.
This doesn't need to be here. This doesn't belong here. And the writer was like, No.
It's important.
It's staying.
Also, you just need it there for Claudia Christian's face. That reaction is gold. And then the classic, the doors close, credits.
Yep.
Perfect way to button up this episode. A perfect, perfect way.
Well, if you have any other problems, any other questions at all, just ask.
Well, now that you mention it, do you have any idea why I suddenly started getting these odd cramps?
This is the Londo Mollari comedy hour featuring his three wives. And my lord, we're talking up about all these performances. Matt Stone, we've got Mira Filan, but really...
Before we get to the main show, I want to acknowledge Vera is great in this episode.
Vera, I was going to say, you're here for all the Centauri performances.
Peter Jurasek, all the Centauri hit it out of the park. But there's a particular moment that I just loved so much.
Is it Vera's laugh? I love his laugh. I love that weird little laugh.
But one specific time that he laughs, which is when Londo makes a joke about his wives, and then he starts to laugh, and then, like, you can tell that he's looking at Timoff, and then he stops laughing because he's like, oh,
she's looking right at me.
Which one do I pick? He's like, did I make the wrong choice laughing at that? Please don't yell at me.
So this is what the episode is all about. It's about the fun Centauri goofiness. And you're here for Peter Jurasek's performance as Londo. You're here for the three wives. You're here for Stephen First as Vera. You're here for Andreas Katsoulis as Jakar to come in and be annoyed by them all. And everybody else kind of filters in. This is, all I wrote in my notes over and over and over again is Londo's so happy.
He's so happy.
He's a very specific type of character played with a very specific type of performance. And if we were not warmed up to him, and hell, I even think that we didn't need two seasons for this, but if you just dropped into this episode and you saw his character with no context, I still feel like you would like this performance and this character, because the pitch of a guy hates his wives and wants to divorce them and he's over the moon about it, you know,
and that it's the emperor had to grant his divorces as well is an interesting aspect to it.
I don't know. There's just something inherently funny about how over the moon he is over the fact that he no longer has to be married to two of his three wives. There's just something funny about that on a level where I don't think you need to know his character from previous episodes to understand why he's performed this way. Because in this episode, he is Londo up to 11. He is doing the full, and Mr. Garibaldi, and
he goes full Londo, and it is, mwah.
Whatever you're doing, Jakar, keep it up. He's going, there's no scenery left at the end of the scene.
No.
When they finish filming, they say, let's do another take. They say, no, we can't do another take. That's the end of the day. Why? Because Peter ate the whole fucking set. And they look around and the whole entire set's gone and he's just wiping his lips going, is there any more left? I'm still hungry. He's still hungry, Rachel. I can't handle Peter Jurasek's performance in this episode. It is a delight. This is why I like Londo so much. He has witty lines here and there, but the stuff I like is actually just the dumb shit. I love his introduction in the episode where he's at the casino and everybody's cheering and it's just his face as he's like, another round, and everybody's like, and he's winning and he's just so overjoyed, and you've got the aliens there. It's goofy. It's fun because the juxtaposition of my husband called me here for a very important meeting. He wouldn't leave me waiting. Hard cut to him just partying. It's not necessarily the most clever. It's not like this isn't sitcom level, but it is just, it's just fun. Mm-hmm. It's hard to describe what is a fun thing for you because it's so specific and personal to yourself, but I don't know, everything he did. My favorite moment from Londo, I don't know what yours is, you can tell me after this, but my favorite moment from him in this whole episode was when the two wives were fighting each other in one of the many times they're fighting, and he breaks them up and goes, like, he half-heartedly pretends to break them up, and then he goes, no, please continue.
Yes.
Just lets them continue fighting each other.
Yeah, I do like that. I like the, he's trying to get an orgy with his wives.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he's just like, oh, this might actually happen.
Oh, I did like that. The piggish nature, because the episode recognizes he's a pig.
Absolutely.
The episode recognizes a piece of shit he is. Timov says it all the time, but I really love in that orgy thing where two of the three are on board, and then he's like, no. We should really wait for Timov to be here. Like, she would somehow be bought on this idea. And then immediately she shoots it about David. His delivery on that line. Think how far he's come since The Gathering. Because he was already funny in The Gathering.
So far.
Both of us. Together.
If it pleases Londo, it pleases me.
No, this isn't right. Timov should be here too.
Do you seriously expect me to become involved in your sexual Olympics?
You can tell that a lot of the actors, pretty much all of the main cast, they are people with comedic sensibilities to them. They have comedic leanings to them, a good portion, if not all of them. And you can tell that every time they're allowed to have a zinger or a gag, or they're allowed to play physical comedy, they go for it. They're not afraid to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's great because... Can you say the same for the entire ensemble of other shows that aren't comedy shows to begin with? Like, can you say that the entire ensemble of Deep Space Nine, TNG, or Enterprise would be as gung-ho about doing comedic stuff?
No.
As the B5 cast are?
No. You just wouldn't.
Yeah. Another Londo favorite moment from me has to be when he gives Jakar his headache at the ceremony. Just him doing the and being all friendly. That's probably one of my favorite moments in the entire episode, is Jakar rocking up to the Ascension wearing shoes, wearing his big boots, and the wives tell him off for how rude that, like, do you know how disrespectful and rude that is? He's like, indeed I do. Mm-hmm. He's so smug and happy, but Londo bounces him off and just completely scrambles his brain. I just love how in both plots of the Matt Stoner plot and the Londo plot, you have two sleazy, creepy men who are so fucking happy with themselves. And they're played very differently to one another, and you have different responses to both of them, but they're both, again, the word of the day here is fun. They are fun to watch.
Yep.
Can we talk about the fact that Jakar routinely seems like he is fucking one of Londo's wives?
Yeah, like they allude that it's an ongoing thing.
What did you think about that?
I was like, we
know Jakar has a thing for a species other than Naan. In fact, I don't think he ever sleeps with a Naan woman. I think he only sleeps with aliens. We've only seen human ladies, and now we know he does Centauri women too. Does he question people? Does Jakar fuck his own kind, or is that his thing? Does Jakar just like testing the pleasure thresholds of non-Nans? That's a question.
Oh, no.
That's a question. We got it. JMS, answer that one in the reboot, please. I'd like an answer to that.
I do want to just, like, this is full of great lines.
Amazing lines.
And amazingly delivered. But the way that Londo describes his wife as being a moth that's attracted to the flame of, like, important men.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I just love that description because there are lots of women like that that exist in real life, and there are lots of women that are made to be like that in media.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, yes, that's it exactly.
But the men get burned.
Mm.
The men get burned. Yeah, the episode is just one of those ones where I could play a whole montage, a whole series of clips of amazing lines. I remember when we did a Discovery episode and I did a whole clip show of all the terrible lines in an episode. This is one where I could do all the great lines. And I'm not going to do that because the episode speaks for itself. You just got to watch it for yourself. It's just one of those. And there's already going to be those sprinkled throughout. But we've got to talk about the pitch is Londo divorces two of his wives. I think it was pretty obvious from the beginning which one he was going to keep.
Yeah.
But I think it's still fun how the episode explores why he comes to that conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Because you still have to put in the legwork for that.
Okay, and do we agree that Timoff is the wife that he was referring to in that story where he met the exotic dancer and she had a voice?
If you want me to kill your joy, I always thought that, but the answer is no, apparently. Oh, no. Apparently, according to books or comics or news net groups or whatever. She's a fourth wife that got divorced or...
Yeah. I kind of picked up that wasn't the case because...
She's, like, too regal?
No, actually. It's a weird, like, continuity sort of thought of he chose to marry her and he says that these were all arranged marriages.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So I'm like, I know that it's not Timoff, but I like to think that it is.
But he chooses Timoff at the end because he knows with her where he stands. She's always honest to a fault, to a brutal degree, but she is an honest person. She is also the one who probably respects him the most out of all of them. She does the right thing and saves his life. I always took it as he figured out from Franklin's comment that Timoff was the reason why he should keep her because she saved him.
I didn't really think that. I think I was just like, Londo is too selfish to think this over. I think the way that I see it is more that, like, well, the younger wife very clearly tried to kill me.
Mm-hmm. And Daguerre's a lying bitch.
Yeah, and she tried to be in on it, or actually was in on it.
Yeah.
But Timoff didn't try and lie to me and didn't try and lie to me at any other point.
Well, I see.
That's why I think he reached that decision.
Yeah, well, I think Franklin's words of advice was a linchpin in his decision making because he seemed pretty over Timoff after having just woken up, and I feel Franklin stepping in saying stick it, get over yourself, gave him a wake up call.
Yeah.
And I've always thought, it's always been my read that he picked up from that interaction with Franklin that Timoff must have done something, probably donated the blood, and he realized that she actually has more value than he's given her credit for, and thus he chooses her at the end. But the thing is, the wives are all unique and fun, and they all make sense as wives for Londo, and they all have reasons for why they hate him that we like about him as a character. But if you were married to him, you would feel that way. If you were married to Londo,
I love that he's just like, aside from, like, all of my savings that you've socked away in different accounts, and just the way that he treats them all like leeches.
Well, he knows them. He knows them to be leeches. That's the greatest thing about it. And Timov's the best wife. We all agree she's amazing. She is so quotable. She's such a badass. She's one that the fandom really likes. There's lots of artworks about her. There's lots of even fan fictions about her further adventures. People just really like this character. And we'll get to her. We're going to do her for the actor spotlight. But I really want to talk about, I really like Daguerre. I think her performance is undervalued. I think she is great because she gets the more pithy lines. Mm-hmm. She also, I love her physicality because she has to wear these little lacy or whatever type of gloves that she's having to wear. And that actress really got a lot out of those gloves as a piece of costuming. Her characterization really came out of those gloves. You could see that it really helped her give her these hand movements that just help you buy her character even more. Can I also say, these actresses, all of the Centauri actresses that we've had, Adira and these three, the bald cap doesn't stop them, huh?
No.
They all managed to act through the bald cap.
Mm-hmm.
You think that they that might be a distraction, and it maybe is for some people, but I don't think it ever took me out of their performances as these three ladies. They're these weird bald women. Never in the moment did I feel the David Warner effect, that we're going to call it, in which it's you just think of this poor actor in some goofy shit and you feel sorry for them. Didn't feel that way at all. At all. I was completely bought in.
Yeah, I love the way that Marielle weaves herself in.
Yeah,
as well. Like,
she keeps coming in and out of the plot.
And she just has that ease and elegance that I'm like, yeah. And I do get the sense that, like, she's very much the third wife, the newest wife. The newer model.
Still the iron claw in the velvet glove, Marielle? Getting your claws into someone else?
Timov, I love you, even if you do not.
This is a filler episode.
Mm-hmm.
And when people talk about filler episodes, they usually talk about it in a negative connotation. Oh, filler episodes. Oh, I just want all story. I just want all plot. I just want all character. And we talk about that too. Mm-hmm. We've done that too. But filler has its place. Filler can be fun. Filler can be just as good as the story arcs and the big pivotal episodes. They are what I would consider to be a lot of my enjoyment of television, are the throwaway, fun, silly filler episodes that you can't say are the measure of a man of TNG, but I still enjoy the Sherlock, the holodeck episodes of TNG nonetheless. Where do you land on the whole throw it away filler episodes? How do you feel about them?
I think filler episodes have their place. And in a show where I enjoy being in the world, I like having a filler episode because it's usually nice and light. But I still get to be in that world.
Yeah. I think they're needed in big, grand sci-fi operas like this. I actually worry very much so that
it's like
in the new...
You don't sprint a whole marathon. And Babylon 5 really is a marathon. So you need those moments where it's a bit slow. There's clarity. You get to feel something different. You get to experience something different. You get to see it from a different angle.
JMS famously stated a few times over the years that when he writes a thing, you know, a very tragic scene, for instance, follow it up with something funny. For fuck's sake, like, for God's sake, have a laugh. Don't be completely humorless. And that is very true. Like in great episodes like Coming of Shadows and Long Twilight Struggle, there'll be all these big, grand, sad things. And then it'll cut away a scene or two later to something a little bit more amusing and a little bit more light, because God forbid you have to be as dreary as you need. You don't need to be this dreary. And this is an episode encapsulating that fully of, we've had a couple of more dour episodes, a more kind of dreary episodes. Let's have a fun one. I think it's very important and necessary to have these episodes in these long-running shows, because I'm actually getting very, very tired of these prestige dramas in which every episode is a high-octane, and you're having to worry about not paying enough attention to detail to all the things happening. And it's not that I'm lacking attention span, but it's more I'm familiar with the patterns of television, as we are with the patterns of 90s television, which, they have a cave set episode, like we say. Yeah. Oh, this is an episode where they have to utilize the cast in this way, and it's we have to have this because we have 22. We need to slot one in where it's kind of a nothing episode where you don't need to have seen the previous ones. People can come in and watch it. That's what this is. This is a necessary beast. It's not required watching. No. It's not pushing the needle forward. But I can't help but like it, and others like it, because it's fun. Mm. That's the thing. If you're having a filler episode, have it be two things to me to be good. Fun or interesting.
Yeah.
Those are the two things. There's another filler episode is the Brad Dourif one where he's the serial killer who's been mind wiped.
Yeah.
That's a filler episode. You don't need it. It doesn't add anything, really. Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting episode. It gets you thinking. Yes. It gets you... And that's what I
need. It has its purpose.
Unlike the Long Dark. In which that episode is there to exist, and nobody cared about the characters enough in that one. Oh, let's make Franklin a creep and a bastard. Why?
Oh, moving kind of fast, aren't you, Doc?
I don't sleep with my patients.
You already said who we're doing, but it's now time to fully discuss Jane Carr's performance as Timmel in our spotlight.
Section. Yep, so spotlight section is where we go over an actor or an actress that has appeared in an episode of Babylon 5 that we're talking about. We go over what we thought of them in it and what we know them from and any interesting facts. So, Timov, the best wife. Jane Carr is the actress, prolific actress. We'll get into her career. Let's talk about Timov a little bit more, that character, that performance. I can't form the words to describe how much she understood what was needed to portray this character. She's harsh, she's mean, she's snooty, but warm and nice underneath it all. You can tell that she actually cares about the world. She's not just a self-centered, apathetic bitch. You do buy that she's somebody that would bite more than once, twice. She is a little lady, but one that I would feel afraid of if I met them in real life, like they are. And Jane Carr gets all of those nuances in this episode, and she's only in this one episode, and she's a very memorable performance, and she again nails exactly what you believe one of Londo's wives would be.
Absolutely.
Like the one that hates his guts and would absolutely never stop ridiculing him, the nagging wife, the persistent squawking bird on his shoulder wife. And she makes the character, and here's the big thing, she makes the character likable. We've seen how many times in media have we seen the squawking, bitchy wife and you don't like them and you go, yeah, for the guy, but you root for her to talk shit about Londo, and when she smacks him, it's such a satisfying moment because he so deserves a smack.
Oh, the physical violence in this episode is great.
There's a little part of you that doesn't expect him to actually get slapped, because usually the Al Bundy type that he is being, you hear the audience rooting and cheering for him. And hey, I love Married with Children, don't get me wrong. But it's like it would be more the insinuation of, oh, I'm going to hit you. But she actually just full on slaps him in the face and just walks out. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm better than this. It's absolutely wonderful. What do you think about her?
I love her. I love that she has no fucking time for this bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, the other two wives are so, so interested in the politics of the situation.
Mm.
And
self-preservation.
She's just like, oh, fuck, whatever. Like, I feel like as soon as she finds out that he's divorcing them, she's still just like, I'm not going to change anything about myself. And Jane Carr brings that, oh, fuck you, this is who I am, energy perfectly.
She makes a shrieking harpy character type into a strong character.
Yeah, and like so much of that is down to her performance.
Now, we're going to get into her work now, and I can already tell, I've skimmed over it, you've looked at it more, but we know Peter Jurasik and Andreas Katsoulis and a few others of this cast to be seasoned pros or to have a certain background to them that it almost feels like their career was building to them playing these roles.
Yeah.
And I get that from Jane Carr before even having a look at her resume of she must have a background of playing certain types of characters and certain types of roles that feel like it's just a natural progression for her to come here and do this as naturally as she does. Because
she slips right in.
Because Peter Jurasik, for instance, as Londo, he played kind of like a sleazy, weird, funny guy character in a previous show just before this. And Andreas Katsoulis has played so many of these type of villainous roles who are also kind of poetic. Mm-hmm. And it goes on and on. And Mira Furlan is just, that's just kind of her, really. But I when I was watching this episode, I couldn't help but think Jane Carr is an actress that has a pedigree that has just led to this role being done as easily as it is. It isn't just, oh, she's got a funny British accent, that will do, and they slap their hands together and just go, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
This is somebody who has played these type of roles so many times, I would imagine, that she's found the humanity within them. Because that's the thing, she makes Timov a real person, yeah, not just a caricature, which the other two wives don't do, because that's not what's needed of them. They don't need to be three-dimensional. The fact that they are so two-dimensional and vapid is the point.
Yeah.
But she needs to be more than that.
Yeah, like stopping and looking at Jane Carr's performance is one of those guest spots where it makes me really appreciate that acting is a craft.
But whatever you may think of me, Doctor, I have some principles that even 20 years with Londo can't erase. I do not like to win my battles this way. I find it vaguely unsatisfying. So you may have your transfusion, Doctor, on one condition. He must never know I did this. I don't think either of us could stand the awkwardness of false gratitude.
So Jane Carr has 125 credits.
And she's still at it, isn't she?
She's still at it. So she was born in 1950, and her first credit on IMDb is in the documentary series Acting in the 60s, which came out in 1967. She was in the episode about Vanessa Redgrave, because they either used footage or shot background footage when she was, like, Vanessa Redgrave was in a film with Jane Carr.
Oh, okay.
And the documentary used that footage because she's credited as her character's name film.
And for those who don't know, Vanessa Redgrave and her father, Michael Redgrave, are British acting legends. They aren't small fish. They're legends. They're huge.
I just think of the spoken word. So she was in The Prime of Miss Jean Brody, and I believe her character's name was Mary, and that film actually came out in 1969. So she was 17 when they were filming it and 19 by the time that it came out. We'll save what I remember her most from.
Yeah. So we have...
But we'll start with her voice acting.
Well, no, I want to talk about first. She's popped up in lots of little things because...
So many of her credits are like in one episode.
Here's an episode of Becca. She's in a couple of episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm, one of which does have Tom Booker, a.k.a. Jinxo, in it. They're not in the same scene, but they're in the same episode. That's interesting. She was in Star Trek Enterprise. She was Malcolm Reed, your favorite character, Malcolm Reed.
Woo.
She was his mother, of course, because she's English. And she is in Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, the best Austin Powers. She's one of the many people in the scenes in which they're pointing at a thing and saying penis in a different way when it's a rocket ship flying up. And she says Pecker, I believe, because she's English, of course. She is just in about everything. She's done it all. She's been
fucking everything.
One and done roles, and even Ellen, Boy Meets World, you name it. She's Tracy Ullman Show, you name it. She's probably been in it, and she was wonderful in it, most likely. And she has transitioned in her later career.
She was even in How I Met Your Mother.
Yeah. And so she's transitioned over the years to do voice acting. She did a video game or two, like an X-Men game as Moira McTaggart. And then she has started to do more voice acting. And her voice acting roles seem to really lean into a certain aspect of her, which is she has this old-fashioned British voice.
Yes.
So it means that she is now playing a lot of grandmother roles or nannies, like a nanny, and the matriarchal type positions because of her voice. And so a lot of her voice creds include many kids' shows in which she plays the grandmother or the mother. Such as Phineas and Ferb. Or she's even in Fairly Odd Parents as Cosmo's mother. And it goes on like that, in which it is voice role after voice role. She's very, very active, still doing this. And I think that's great because it is her voice that you remember a lot of too. And it makes sense for her. Like, she's even a nanny in Kim Possible. She was one of the major voices. She was even in Rachel, not a voice, but she was in Hannah Montana, the movie.
She was also in Numbers and Garfield 2.
The one set in England.
Yeah,
so
obviously.
So that makes sense. And Postman Pat.
Also Air Buddies.
Who hasn't been in Air Buddies? But she is still at it. But Rachel, you learned something about her that was very... Well, no. Let me take credit here. I saw a credit here and I said, well, Rachel must know the answer to this. I saw two words, Gilmore Girls. And I thought, well, Rachel, she's in three episodes of Gilmore Girls. You must know who she is because she's in more than one.
And it took me a minute.
And I actually said, she must be iconic in it. And you kind of went, You went, I don't know. I don't know who this is to begin with.
Yeah.
But you had to think about it.
As soon as I saw what three episodes she was in, I was like, oh, fuck, she's the DAR lady.
Explain, please. I'm not a Gilmore guy, so I don't know Gilmore lore.
So later on in the series, Rory drops out of Yale and moves in with her grandparents because her mom's really pissed that she's dropped out of college.
She moves in with the best characters in Gilmore Girls, the grandparents, yes.
And
your grandfather likes trains.
Yes, he does. the DAR, I had no fucking clue what that was, and I had to Google it when I was watching this show because they don't immediately explain what it is, and I was just like, why are they making such a big deal about this?
What is it?
It's an organization called the Daughters of the American Revolution.
Is this a real thing? Or is it just for the show?
I think it's a real thing.
I'm so sorry. So what is this? So she's in Gilmore Girls as this old lady who's a part of the DAR, Daughters of American Revolution.
Yes. And she's the horn dog.
Well, what is the group?
So
I don't know what this means.
They are like a sort of charitable organization where they do like work and support for the military. But to be a member, you have to be a woman who had like ancestors
that were important to the revolution.
Yeah, that participated
in
the American Revolution. Yeah.
Or was she on the side of not being in the revolution? That would have been an interesting twist. Now, we watched one scene with this because you need to show me, and she's Jane Carring the fuck out of the scene. She's hilarious.
I had it
wonderful.
In my head.
She's snooty. She's bitchy. She's
I'm
great.
Like, she's the one that's hot for Hamilton.
She was ahead of her time.
She was ahead of her time.
She was ahead of her time.
And I was just like, I'm pretty sure she's like, I have a massive lady boner for Hamilton, and she's having to defend it.
She's the only one who's and up for Hamilton's dick.
And I remember that correctly because then, like, everybody's like, oh, yeah, we picked Washington or Jefferson, and it's just Nora that's gone for Hamilton, and she's defending her choice, and Rory is taken aback.
Yeah, by everyone being horny for presidents, and
this
all
is
this.
Their discussion at a like afternoon luncheon in her grandma's backyard.
Yeah, they're all horny for founding
patio.
Fathers. Yeah,
and I'm pretty sure she continues to be horny. When, like, because the function that Rory organizes later on has a bunch of boy drama, and she's like, that's a hot piece of tasty you got there, Rory.
So that's her. That's Jane Carr. She's still out there. She's a legend. She's amazing. One of the last facts I learned was she is in fact in DC's Legends of Tomorrow as a fairy, as the fairy godmother. And due to that show, she finally got to do a fight scene in a movie or show for the first time in her 60s. But isn't that cool?
Yeah.
How fun for her. That must have been fun, or at least scary. It's one or the other.
Probably at least a bit of both.
What would you rate this, Soulmates?
Yum yum.
Yum yum.
I rated a yum yum.
Yum yum.
It's not a flawless episode. We could have picked it apart much more, but there's just one where I smile.
Yeah.
When I watch it. Hopefully, next week, we'll have an episode that makes me smile. What are we watching next time?
On an all-new Babylon 5.
Episode 8, A Race Through Dark Places. Babylon 5 may be an underground railroad for unregistered telepaths to slip through the dragnet of Psycorp Cop Bester, Walter Koenig.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Sheridan squabbles with Earth Central over rental fees levied against their quarters.
Oh, that's a great plot. I love that plot. I don't snore. Well, people, make sure to give that episode a watch in the meantime so that you're all ready, Freddy, to go. You can, while you're doing that, you can also follow us on the social media platform of your choice. We're on all of them practically. We are Yum Yum Podcast or Yum Yum Pod, depending the one. All of this is in the description of this episode. You can email us at
yumyumpod@gmail.com.
We also do, in fact, have a Patreon.
Yes.
In which we make bonus content. We work very hard on it. It would be greatly appreciated if you have the means and the desire to come and support us over there. We are going through the X-Men feature films at the moment. So yes. We are doing all of the those Fox X-Men films, including Deadpool, including the Wolverine movies. Mm-hmm. We are also, we've also been talking about on there. We've been talking about Star Trek.
Yes, the best and worst rated episodes of the various series of Star Trek, according to IMDb. Looking at some episodes of Enterprise, all of which I think are shit.
No. No, there are some you have liked, in all fairness. And yeah, we've been going through them all. So if you want to hear our opinions on some of the best and some of the worst of Star Trek,
and we
come on over
also
there.
Give our opinions on other pieces of media, including some video games and TV shows.
Yep, and podcasts. So come on over, have a great time. It would be wonderful if you did. But that is all. Jakar was here. He was gagging.
He really should have said this to Marielle. Would have been perfect.
He was gagging to say it, and he just choked. He choked on a grape.
So
he got a headache and he couldn't say it.
We've
got
to say it.
Good eating to you. Good eating to you.
Ah, Mr. Kelly.